Hello and welcome to The Easy Button, the podcast that doesn't have an introduction this week because I haven't thought of one. Your hosts today are James Prendergast and...
This is Taylor Boone. How y'all doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. About yourself?
I'm doing all right.
That's great. Doing all right. Okay. So we'll jump straight in. Try and keep it fairly succinct and short this week.
I'm
going to try a new couple of things. I've got a timer going, so I'm not going to overrun too far. So what we'll do, we'll go straight into the water cooler. Or switch around the water cooler. I don't want to drown. And just talk about the games we've been playing. I think we're actually going to combine our two together because you've been playing Fallout 3 and I've been playing Fallout 1. And I thought it'd be quite interesting to have a little look at the kind of comparison between the two games and what's good and what's not.
Let's go.
So, I don't know, do you want to go first or shall I go first?
You can go first. That's Fallout is the beginning,
okay.
Right?
Because this is the first time I've played this game. So it's been quite an interesting experience for me because I think one of the things with the original Fallout, it's notoriously old school in kind words in its interface, where you have to like pickpocket your companions to be able to give them things. You can't dictate what they do apart from how far away they are from you.
Yep.
In combat, you can't control them. You can't say use this weapon or switch to that weapon.
And they are stupid too.
Yeah. So they'll have. I'm playing through now. I'm not optimizing anything. I'm playing the character I made, and there's so many FAQs out there about where you can go, what you can do, and, you know, and how you can break the game or whatever. You can min max,
right,
as they call it. And I'm.
This isn't a game that you want to min-max, I don't think. I mean, especially your first playthrough, I think you really want to get in and enjoy it because there's a lot of good... You know, there's a lot of feel that you kind of lose when you min-max in this game.
And I think as well, one of the things I'm discovering is that there's a lot of choice, even though you don't really necessarily realize it.
Right.
So it's dead easy to miss people you might want to talk to, or it's easy to completely piss off everyone in the town and get yourself kicked out.
Well, but to me, that's part of the charm of the game, right?
Definitely.
And if you go through and min-max, so you see, you know, if you're one of these all the content, all the time guys, I mean, that's great on a subsequent playthrough, I think, but the first playthrough, it's really fundamentally, at least... From my perspective, the Fallout series is about exploration and not knowing what's going to happen, what's around the corner, and not having much of you're trying to figure out the system of the game and how you know the RPG elements, you know, interconnect and interact with the world. That's part of the joy of the game, and going and reading the FAQ and min-maxing and you know, is kind of defeating the whole purpose of playing the game. It's like, why not just watch it all on YouTube or something?
Yeah. Well, I must admit, I have had to use a Google search a couple of times. Like, I couldn't work out how to sleep, and it's a bell symbol for some strange reason.
It's an alarm clock. That's your alarm clock.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense once you think about it like that, but, you know, I don't know, maybe a bubble with Z's in it or something, or like a word saying sleep or rest.
Right, well, probably.
It's just, because I don't have a manual, you see, because I got it on Full Games, and I think possibly you can download manuals, didn't
you? Yeah, you can, absolutely. The manual is actually, I would recommend you download the manual, and because the manual, I mean, remember, games of this era, the manual was part of the entire experience of the box, the game and the manual, and if there's any toss ins, right?
Yeah, and you would definitely, you would always read the manual, wouldn't you? But as it was, as the game's installing before you started playing, because otherwise, usually the kind of, in a bad way and a good way, because manuals are less required now, in a bad way, you know, games didn't hold your hand in the old days. You had to read the manual to learn how to play the game. Whereas one of the kind of things that I suppose has been learned over the years is tutorials and bringing people into the game gradually. That kind of skill has been honed by, you know, developers, isn't it?
Right. That's true. But to me, you lose a little bit because, I mean, the manual, this is one of the best manuals for setting the tone of the game. And, you know, that retro 50s-ish futuristic America.
Yeah, it's a very irreverent, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Kind I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of good flavor in there I think is worth reading just for the flavor, even if you already know the mechanics of the game because you've been playing it. It does give a lot of that flavor that I think is very important when coming to a game like this.
Okay, I'll have a look through them because I read through Fallout 3's manual and I quite enjoyed that, even though it was it wasn't like massively thick or anything.
Right.
But it did have those snippets of information. Well, not really. So it's not really information, are they? They're just like kind of like anecdotes and stuff.
Right. It's more flavor. It's setting the tone of the game, and I think one of the reasons why the Fallout 3 manual was even there in this era of no manuals, right, or minimal manuals, was kind of a harkening back or callback to the Fallout games, which had these excellent, awesome manuals. Mm-hmm. I mean, these were spiral-bound
manuals
you could lay flat. Not as long as a flight simulator manual that were usually spiral-bound in that era as well, but you know, it was meant to be a permanent document and feel like a permanent document. And so I think, Fallout 3's inclusion of a manual was, kind of a callback to that, which I think was part of the charm of Fallout 3.
To give credit to Bethesda, they always include manuals in their games. So even Oblivion had one, and that listed all the spells and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, because their games are so
expansive, I suppose, aren't they? Yeah.
Obtuse, I think, is the word.
But as you say, though, the flavor was unique in all the Bethesda games to Fallout 3.
Right.
I don't know whether New Vegas has got it as well. I haven't played that one.
I'm not going to play that one until it gets well patched, and then maybe not even then because I haven't heard very good things about it.
Yeah. But let's not divert into that. So I've been playing the game. I thought I'd be sneaky. I thought I'd be clever, I should say.
Okay.
In that I was going to do I focused my skills in medicine, in like so first aid, and agility, and intelligence, and talking. I thought, being an old school game, I should be able to get through most situations without much fighting. Get a companion or two, and I'll kind of try and edge my way through the game. And I managed to lose dog. I managed to get dog meat, losing. he got cornered, and I couldn't heal him.
Right. Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah. So.
Poor dog.
Well, I hadn't had him on that long. Hadn't had him that long, unfortunately, because I managed to get into a fight with some guys in Junktown, and then I was kicked out. told not to come back.
That's awesome.
I actually missed. It took me a long time to level up because I think I got to level 2, and then because I missed pretty much all the quests and content in Junktown, I was quite underleveled when I got to the hub, which is my next kind of destination.
Right.
So I went down there and I struggled for a little while, even though I had tons of money. I don't know where I got it from. I think it was from about 15 or something, whatever it was. But yeah, and then I got lost because I could have sworn I had to go talk to the water traders to find out where the other vault was, which is under Bakersfield or something. But when I was talking to them, the only options I had was to send water to my vault or not. So then I ended up in a kind of weird situation where I was giving money to do something that I didn't really want to do, and I didn't get anything back from it. I didn't get a location of Bakersfield, so I'm kind of wandering around the map now. I'm a little bit lost, not sure what to do. And I found this other place, and I'm kind of getting two sides to kind of fight each other, and I'm trying to work out which one's the best one to side with.
Right.
So that's been quite interesting.
See, that's awesome, though. I mean, it kind of sucks that you got thrown out of Junktown because there's some interesting things that happen in there.
Mm.
But I think it's awesome, and it points to, I mean, this is a game that doesn't hold your hand, right? If you make a mistake, well, you got to deal with the consequences, right?
Yeah. And sometimes as well, I mean, I do enjoy that. I do wish sometimes that there was more kind of a warning. What you're going to do was going to be that harsh on your kind of rating with everyone. Although, to be fair, if you're just quite out of the vault, if you're playing in character, you have no idea of the rules of the world either.
Right. That's exactly
right. You're kind of there with your character, you know, in the mind of your naive character.
Right. I mean, your world is, the world outside of Vault is 100% different from inside, and you mm-hmm. have to kind of learn as you go, and, you know, it seems that you would make some mistakes along the way, and maybe you've made a worse mistake than a lot of people would, but, you kind of live with those consequences.
It was totally their fault. They attacked me, and I defended myself, and I got chucked out. You know, killed a couple of people that the guy Killian wanted dead anyway.
Yeah.
Lamers. So how have you been finding Fallout 3? Because I know you are a big fan of the original ones.
Yeah. Well, I'm finished Fallout 3. And this is, you know, Fallout 3 is a game that does a lot of things right and harkens back successfully to Fallout, to the original Fallout and Fallout 2. But ultimately, I think I found feels a little soulless.
Okay. Are you talking about the world, or are you talking about the storyline? What do you mean the whole package?
The whole package. I mean, there are interesting things to do and interesting places to go see, right? But it does feel rather static in you know, the Oblivion, Morrowind, Bethesda RPG sort of way, right? Where we talked, I think, on the last podcast about locations for role-playing games really existing and you're projected into them, or you're the whole reason for the world to be there.
Yes.
Very few exceptions. I always felt like this world existed for me to be in, not to be part of. And, that's too bad, right? That's because they have a nice, real, well-realized area to explore and look at, but, at the end of the day, you don't feel like you're part of anything. And then also the ending of Vanilla Fallout 3 is the world's worst.
Yeah. The whole storyline is pretty terrible.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with that.
There's Seamus Young? Is Seamus Young?
Yeah.
There's a guy I've talked about before on the podcast. And he did a kind of like a Let's Play kind of a Fallout 3 with some people. And they just picked apart all plot holes, and plot holes that I hadn't even thought about before were there, and it was just whoever wrote the storyline either was a 13-year-old, English student doing a project for his teacher, or they just I can't believe it was actually written by professional script writers or game writers.
Yeah, it was just, well, and I think problem with having a deep, meaningful storyline in a game that's so open as this is the fact it's so open. You have to accommodate all these endless possibilities happening, and so you end up having a plot that is extremely bare bones and doesn't have a lot of interest to it, because you never know when you're going to stumble upon a plot point and trip something in the plot.
Yeah, well, I mean, they kind of, They got around that in a lot of places by actually railroading the player, so you could not access those areas without, you know, going
right. Through that's true, especially toward the end game.
Yeah.
But even then, it's like you're still, you know, even toward the end. And I don't want to spoil the game at all, in case there's anybody out there who hasn't played it that wants to. But
it's quite a few years old.
Yeah, probably. But I mean, you get toward the end, and you can even get to the point where you're, hey, we're about to go do this thing.
Oh, yeah, you can just wander off, yeah.
And you just wander off and go mess around. And as a matter of fact, if you're playing Vanilla Fallout, you better go wander off and do anything that you're interested in, because you won't get a chance to do it afterwards.
No, that is the worst part of the game as well. I think it's the only open world game that ends and that's it.
Yeah, that pissed me off. I'm still pissed off about that.
Yeah, I was really annoyed about that. But the interesting thing about it is it feels to me like the game didn't quite know what it wanted to be. Like, I think takeaway message from the game is that they love the Fallouts. They love them. And they wanted to make homage to them. I think they did a very good job. But the problem was, they weren't quite sure whether to make a normal Bethesda game or make a Fallout game.
Right.
And, you know, the ending, to me, is typically Fallout. Do you know what I mean? That's your choice. That's the end. Problem yeah. was, there was no choice.
Right.
And leading up to it, there was... The whole plot was stupid. Because yeah. I'm actually going to spoil it because I want to talk about it a little bit. Because
okay.
they were having an argument, basically, over who got to make free water for everyone.
Yes.
Because the people aren't going to patrol the whole of the basin. It was like a massive lake or whatever it was, or some kind of water, body of water that you could not cross. That, you know, you could see the extent of it. It was huge. And it would have affected the whole of the wasteland. And they would have not been able to stop access to that water. So okay. I don't know what the problem was. It doesn't matter who was in charge of it as long as it was switched on and both sides wanted to switch it on.
Right. Yeah, just let somebody switch it on.
Yeah, and why couldn't they work together? That's the thing I didn't understand. I don't understand why the government, unless it's some kind of, you know, anti-government message that the developers happen to have or the writers happen to have, the government came in and said, we want to... Well, for some reason, they were very antagonistic. They didn't even come and say, we want to help you with your project.
Right.
You know, we want to
take it over.
Yeah, and then the first thing they do is, who's in charge here? I'm in charge. Bang. They shoot the person who can tell them what to do.
Yep.
You know, it's just... what?
Well, it's kind of puerile, and I think it tries to harken back to, you know, in the Fallout games, mm-hmm. I don't want to spoil anything there, but government is not always your friend.
Yes, yeah.
Right? The powers that be aren't looking out for your best interest. And I think that was kind of an attempt to pay an homage to that.
Okay.
But it's nonsensical.
yeah.
It's nonsensical in this context. I think they're just... I think in Fallout 3, they thought, hey, wouldn't it be cool if we had this kind of shadow government, you know, a shell of the U.S. government that still existed, you know, in some enclave somewhere, right? The enclave.
Yes, yeah.
And the guy who was running it was insane. How cool would that be? And, of course, our guy, you know, the good people are going to be fighting against that because nobody else in that world is insane either, right? I mean, it's just, you know, you start – anytime if you sit down and analyze this game, it just – the plot, you're right. It doesn't make any sense. There's so many plot holes. You'd drive a fleet of Mack trucks through them, right?
Yeah. And the worst part for me, there's two terrible parts apart from the ending. And one of them I don't really want to talk about it because everyone's talked about it loads is the little lamplight thing. Can't kill children. Can't get around them. And they make you kiss their feet, basically.
Yes.
You know.
And they wallow in their...
invulnerability.
In the fact that you... Yeah, their invulnerability. Exactly.
So it's just that's the worst kind of thing ever. And also that didn't make any sense because they send people away from that place when they get to adulthood. So where do the new babies come from?
Yeah. Exactly. That's a good point.
So that kind of confused me as well. But what I was, you're this hugely powerful character usually if you've been going around the world, and I want to talk about that in a second, which I think is great. And all of a sudden, you're overpowered by a couple of guys that 10 minutes later, you're killing by the truckload.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. So that's... I mean, so for most of that game, I didn't play for the plot.
Mm.
I mean, you know, you come out of the vault, you come out near Megaton, I did a couple of missions there, then it just went away.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing to do in that game, which is why the ending pissed me off so much, was I just like to say, hey, let's go north.
Yes. Yeah.
And just start walking and see what's out there. And there's so many things that are out there. It's amazing. It's so much fun to stumble across the unexpected little mini plot line and, you know, or stumble into an abandoned factory and see what's going on in there. Or, you know, on one of my little excursions, I actually happened across the slaver camp.
Oh, yes, yeah. I think Paradise Falls?
Yeah, Paradise Falls. And I stumbled across it by accident, and I killed all the slavers without actually having stumbled upon the plot that leads you there.
Yeah.
You know, so
could you rescue,
there's just so many...
There's children to rescue in there. Could you rescue them before you had the...
Yeah, you could. But I had no context for why. It just seemed like the good thing to do because I was being a good guy.
Oh, yeah.
Playing a good character. And, but there's no, you know, then after a play, you know, read that, yeah, there's a whole sequence of events that leads you there on a mission. And I never saw any of that mm-hmm. because I just kind of stumbled upon it and said, hey, this looks an interesting place. Oh, these guys are shooting at me. Well, then they're all going down. Anybody who's shooting at me, automatically is going to get shot back.
Yeah.
And by this time, I was pretty high level, so I was able to take care of business, as we like to say.
That's a funny thing. Like, well, it's not really funny, I suppose, but Fallout 3 suffers from the same thing that all Bethesda games and all Obsidian games... No, maybe not Obsidian, sorry. Who did Knights of the Old Republic? One.
BioWare,
that's the one. Those two companies suffer from extreme good or extreme evil. You know, if you're a bad guy, you're an ass. And, you know, you do everything possible to get in the player's way. And even if the player's a bad guy as well, they're still an ass to you, but they don't kill you because they're like bad guys. Because evil likes evil, right?
Evidently.
Yeah, it's just...
Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, because when you first talk to that slaver guy, as you go into the camp, I don't know if you did or whether you walked past him. I think if you walked past him, you saw the open fire.
Yes.
But if you talk to him, he's like, he's just so disrespectful. And even if you start taking, because you can get slave collars, you can go and make people slaves, and you can bring,
can
send them back to the camp.
I didn't do that. So yeah, I can say I wiped him out before I knew what they were.
Yeah, no, I tried that on because I didn't do it on the first one. I always play a good guy in these kind of things. But yeah, I played through three times now. Not through the story, but just around the world. And then one of them, I was a bad guy and made people slaves. That was actually quite interesting, actually, because the mechanic of making people slaves was quite difficult. Because if people saw you do it, they'd all attack you.
Right. Yes.
So it was kind of like a stealth element to the game, which wasn't really used that much.
Right. Yeah, like I say, that world is weird. It's been a while since I played Fallout and Fallout 2, but those worlds seem like they hung together a little bit better, and perhaps it was because the location, the detail, you know, what I consider detail locations, right?
Yeah.
Junktown, for instance, were so disconnected from everything else.
Yes, yeah.
That only that one little area had to make...
complete
textual
sense
within itself, right? And, you know, you only have, you know, 7 or 8 or maybe a dozen real NPCs that mattered that had to have meaningful dialogue and meaningful, interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
You didn't have to worry about, you know, square miles and square miles of that wasteland where it was all continuous. And so I think any discontinuities in Fallout were hidden by the fact that all of these areas were discontinuous, right? You kind of jump from one to one. And if you start going back, you start to see more and more of the characters that you know, and you see how things kind of work in that area. But, you know, it just makes more sense because it's a smaller area. And so it's easier to, I assume it's easier for them to develop, you know, a story and how everything fits together a lot tighter than like Fallout 3, which is just, you know, it's just totally wide open.
Yeah, I think one of the things I dislike about Fallout compared with Fallout 3 is that the habitable places are really... They're too big for what they are. There's too much empty space. It's too unfocused. I think they could have done with trimming it down a little bit. Because sometimes you're going through places like the hub and you just want to get out. You need to go through a few screens. And it's all mostly empty space... half abandoned buildings, you know, and that's a little bit annoying sometimes.
Well, especially given that the mechanics for moving stuff around are so relatively primitive, right?
Yeah. I mean,
you know, you can't just, you can only see, like I say, you can only see a screen worth of, you know, of stuff. And so you can't, like, scroll to the edge of town and click
that's
and
right, yeah.
have the guy go. It's like you have to go to the edge of the screen, go to the next screen. Have him run across that screen, go to the next screen. Have him run across that screen. Then you're finally out, right?
I must admit, it's a bit weird, because I don't understand whether that was a limitation of technology at the time or whether they just chose to do that.
That was a limitation of technology at the time.
No, oh, well...
You can only hold...
So even within the same square of the map, that you had to, you couldn't scroll to the edge of the screen,
right?
Okay,
because they were only because they had you know not to get too nerdy, but you know there's only so much. I mean, these things only had so much memory, right?
Yeah,
so much video 16 memory.
16 megabytes if you're lucky.
Well, you couldn't use it right back in that day.
Couldn't you?
I mean, Fallout's a DOS game, right?
All right, okay.
I mean, you could. I don't remember if it used HiMem or. You know, any of those wonderful technologies for using more memory, but most of the time you only had a really fixed amount of memory and you could only show what was on the screen plus a little bit on each side so you could scroll a little bit, but you know, basically you're limited to what you can show on the screen. That's all you really have available to you as far as display goes, right? You have obviously data structures that represent the rest of the world and where things are but as far as drawing and being able to scroll around, you're really limited on what you can do. And so, yeah, I mean, we forget how limited the technology was back when Fallout came out, which was, what, 90...
Did I know, 1992 or something? I don't know. It's quite...
92 is pretty early, right? You know? And so, yeah, DOS are just... Back in those days, there just wasn't a lot of things you could do there, having programmed back in DOS. You know, got to see... What you could not do.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, and also to be fair, I mean, you yourself as a user didn't have a lot of options either. So I had a turbo button on my PC that in one of the incarnations didn't work. It's funny to think back then how even though I suppose the games were designed for the systems, it didn't necessarily mean that the systems would run them smoothly.
Right. Yeah, and especially I mean, if you think about. You know, these days, you know, everybody has a 2 gigahertz chip.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people have a 3 gigahertz chip. And most people have multi-core in some form or fashion, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's hyper-threading or actual multi-core. Think about the difference between just take 2 to 3 megahertz or 2 to 3 gigahertz versus, you know, 66 to 90 megahertz. I mean, that's a huge, you know, 66 to 90 is a huge jump in performance versus 2 to 3 gigahertz, right?
Yeah, yeah. And especially as well, you know, we're talking about out of order chips. So brute force is the order of the day, isn't it, really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and plus, you know, the state of the art has come a long way, both on hardware and software techniques. So.
Oh, there's a lot more specialized circuitry in chips now that help with like mathematical instructions and stuff like that.
So you did have a lot of limitations back then, mm-hmm. and it turns out that Fallout was released in 1997, which seems a lot later than
it was in 1997. Wow.
Yeah, that's what Moby Games says at least.
That probably makes more sense. I think Doom was 1992 or 1994. So I think yeah, it was a bit later than Doom, graphically. Yeah, but
yeah.
No, I have been having fun, and with Fallout 3, I think. I enjoyed looking around the world as well, and especially enjoyed that you could see on your radar, and you could turn it off if you wanted to, but you could see on your radar settlements and points of interest, which really helps. Because where I am at the moment in the hub, wherever the people down south are, I can't remember what they're called now. I'm trying to get to these gunrunners that I don't know where they are, and I can't seem to find them. I can't seem to find the exit from the screen to where they are. So it's a little bit annoying.
Well, I think, but again, I would say, yeah, it's kind of annoying, especially with modern sensibilities. But when you think about it, you're wandering around the wasteland, man. Ain't no auto hubs in there.
No.
Right? I mean,
yeah, it's all long footwork. I must admit, it's a good job they're giving you what, like 400 days or something, because otherwise I'd be dead by now.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's that limitation was both annoying and kind of compelled you to get, you know, get off your butt and start looking around for
you things, couldn't, right? You couldn't just go and do whatever you wanted forever and ever. Like you can in Fallout 3. It focuses you a little bit. And I think maybe they should have put that in. Maybe there should have been an element of time sensitiveness in Fallout 3.
Yeah, but and maybe the game would have been a little bit better for it, but on the other hand...
Well, the story, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what? How could they have made that work, you know, filling a time element? I'm sure it would have been screwed up somehow with the ham-headed way they treated the rest of the story, right?
One thing that I think is missing from Fallout 3 is I think characters are less interesting. I think that you were saying before about you exploring the world, you're going to see interesting things. That you've got the old robot factories and stuff like that, and they are really cool, but there aren't really a lot of interesting quests or, you know, characters or anything. Right. Most of them are, I guess, a little bit bland.
Yeah, they, well, again, this kind of goes back to the weakness of Bethesda, is they generally don't have interesting characters, and they don't have an interesting dialogue.
I mean, it did,
the way the characters are reminded me that this is really Fallout with, you know, or Oblivion with guns,
yes,
right?
Yep.
I mean, it's, you know, the blank, dead stare of everybody is just kind of creepy, and very similar to Oblivion. It's just...
Yeah. Although I enjoyed Fallout 3 much, much more than Oblivion.
Really?
Yeah, I really like the VAT system as well. Because obviously the game doesn't really control very well in point-and-shoot mode.
Yeah, it's certainly not a first-person shooter.
Not really, no.
I mean, again, I played Oblivion the same way I played Fallout 3, mm-hmm. right? Which is, hey, today we're going to go... this way,
yeah.
And the plot in Oblivion is actually crappy too. I think it's a little bit better in the sense that at least you're not interacting all the time, you know.
Yes, yeah.
There's a game that they should have put a timing element, because hey, hell's coming on Earth, and yeah. We can just go roll around and do whatever the hell we want to and ignore it.
And Oblivion gates are like opening up all over the place and stuff, and you can ignore them if you want. There's no adverse effect on the population.
Right. I mean, that's stupid.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I did, I think, was better in Oblivion was that there was more varied quests, and also on the main quest, there was more variations. It wasn't just fetch quests or go
right.
here. You had invasions, you had repelling enemies.
Yeah, and you had
like
to go
that.
Into Oblivion.
It was a little bit more...
Yeah, there's definitely more, you know, there's more interesting things to do, which I think is what makes the plot better. But yeah, still, Bethesda needs to find people who can write good plots to put in their worlds, because their worlds are incredible, right? Morrowind.
Yeah.
I mean, even going back to the earlier games of the Elder Scrolls series, right? I mean, Daggerfall.
Yeah, I didn't play them, yeah.
Daggerfall, for its time, was just huge, and you could do... I mean, as a matter of fact, when I played the game, I never finished Daggerfall, because it was just a huge game, but you could go do anything you wanted to do. It was just crazy, the amount of freedom that you had, and the plot was a little bit convoluted, so I lost the thread of the plot and never found it again, but they make these really... great worlds with lots of things to discover. Now, you might argue whether they're interesting things to discover or not. That's a whole other argument, but there's a lot of things to discover.
Yeah.
But they've never had good characterization, and they've never had good dialogue. I mean, they do the kind of the antithesis of BioWare, in my mind.
Yes, yeah. Although, to be fair, BioWare does sometimes stumble on that as well. You sometimes have like random moments where your character will freak out even though you didn't intend them to.
Yeah, but in general, BioWare's dialogue and plot lines are far superior to Bethesda's.
Yeah,
but I think the worlds with perhaps Baldur's Gate 1 perhaps being the exception aren't as well populated, I guess.
Yeah. I think they're very corridor based yeah. worlds I tend to find, especially KOTOR and well, even Mass Effect. Like you have an open world in theory, but where you go is like it's like you have a magical transporter between different worlds.
Right. Yes.
And in Mass Effect and KOTOR is the ship, and in like Jade Empire you kind of walk and also like a flying machine and stuff right. like that. But yeah, they're not really open world in the sense that, well, not even half of the sense that Bethesda's
right. Made. I mean, take Dragon Age, right? Another RPG, a relatively new RPG. I mean, that's a point to point experience, right? You don't walk between the cities and see what's between the cities.
Okay.
You go point to point, and you know, KOTOR is similar, right? You go point to point. You go to a planet and
yes.
you roll around whatever's there, and then you go back to your ship and you go to the next planet. You don't see what's between the spaces.
No.
Whereas,
to be fair, I think most of it would be uninteresting, wouldn't it? You wouldn't really want to do that.
Well, maybe. I mean, but I think Bethesda could find some stuff to put in between the spaces because they do.
Yeah.
Well, you know?
Well, I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? Both companies have excelled at something that they've concentrated on for the last
right.
10 years or
right.
so.
It would be very nice. It would be very cool to see a collaboration between Bethesda and BioWare where Bethesda builds the world and then BioWare populates with interesting people with interesting things to say. That would be like a dream.
Well, I mean, that comes back to the thing that we keep revisiting. Is that if someone makes a world, we want someone else to alter it or put content in it. You know, you're saying about Fuel and about Red Dead
right.
Redemption and Dead Dead Redemption, and that it would be great if, because do you remember Gathering of Developers?
Yes,
it was like a kind of like a
yep.
collaborative amalgamation of independent
yep.
developers, and they self-published and stuff like that. What would be really cool is if the IDGA, or whatever they're called, or some kind of developer association came together and said, look, we want to make a super project. We want to do something which is going to further games as art, but also as a business.
Right.
And if they said, okay, you're going to make the world, we're going to make three worlds or two worlds, whatever, and then we're going to make modules that sit on top of those worlds, and they're going to be different games.
Right.
You know, go away and do it and work out the collaborations between yourselves. That would be amazing. I mean, there was a thing on gameindustry.biz the other day. I think it was either Take-Two or THQ. One of those bosses was saying game prices should come down, and what we'll do instead is we'll charge more through DLC. And he reckons that we'll actually, if they improve the way they provide content, they may get customers paying up to $100 or more per, you know, over time. And that would be a way of doing it.
Well, and you know what? I would absolutely, yeah, I'm like a target for that, right? It's like,
me too.
And I think Rock Band's proven that if you build a platform and you keep delivering content. Now I realize the context is different, but you know, song is different from, you know, a 2 or 3 hour
yeah,
experience.
Yeah.
But if you build a platform and you keep delivering content on top of the platform, that you can have some success, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that Bethesda doesn't really do very well. Going back to Fallout 3, you know what I wouldn't have minded paying for actually in an expansion is more random encounters. There were a few random encounters in Fallout 3 itself, and some of them were more interesting than the other ones. Like the Chinese radio of the dead paratrooper and stuff like that.
Right.
But it would have been great to have, rather than things like horse armor or different weapons, to have new random encounters
right.
in different places.
Yeah.
To expand what's interesting about the world, rather than make another lame single player story.
Did you play any of the DLC for Fallout 3? I didn't bother.
I watched through two of them on spoiler warning, the thing with Seamus Young, and to me they weren't worth the money at all. They were completely linear, completely linear.
Right. Okay. I haven't played it. I say when I finished that game, I was done.
Yeah, it doesn't exactly make you want
to. I really wanted that game to die in a fire. I mean, I was so pissed off. But
did you know it was coming as well when you?
I was totally shocked when you did. You know, you input that code in the chamber filled with radiation, and you were dead, and it faded to credits, and then you could not go back and continue to play. I was shocked, which is probably why I'm so pissed off about it.
I mean, I knew when I went, I knew before I did that scene that was going to happen, and I was annoyed even knowing it. And the thing that annoyed me the most, apart from the lack of logic in it, because who would make a device that makes you switch it on and then kill yourself?
Well, I think it was because it got damaged in the final little shootout.
But why couldn't you escape? Like, there was an airlock there, yeah. So even if there was a containment problem, you'd enter the airlock, yeah. Evacuate the, you know, through the filters, and then come out the other side. But there was binary choice as well. It was like, you can sacrifice yourself, hint hint, this is a good option, or you can sacrifice this woman here.
Yeah.
It's like...
Well, and the thing is that, you know, and the kicker, the real kicker, is standing 2 feet away from you is an NPC that's already gone through extreme radiation to give you something.
Oh yeah, if you're playing the good,
yeah.
If you're a good guy, yeah, he sees up, and he can't die either. He's completely immune to radiation.
Yeah, and that's the real kicker is I'm standing 2 feet away from this guy who could go in and live through this, and he won't go, which is fine, I guess. But ugh.
The thing that's funny as well, it's already been established because he went and got the gap.
Yes,
and that was lethal levels of radiation.
Yeah, that was the kill. That's the thing that was the kick. That was the final kicker. What I expected to have happen, Jim, is I expected you to go in, do the thing, and then it come back and say, miraculously, you were saved. Or, you know, you wake up in the infirmary and it's like, hooray, you're the hero. Now you can keep playing, right? Which is kind of similar, which is what happened in Oblivion, right? You finally...
Yeah, I don't know.
I finished the storyline because I'm crazy. But you know, you finally seal off Oblivion. You know, you finish the quest, you make the king.
Yeah.
You have the final fight, and then it's like, hey, you're the hero, and you're done. But you're still there, and you can still go tool around and do any quests that you hadn't completed. That's what I expected. And when I got game over, I was pissed. I'm still pissed. I mean, it's just, that's not what you...
The thing is, it's such a ridiculous way to end the game as well, isn't it? It's not even a noble death.
Right. Well, I guess it is. And you sacrifice yourself for everybody else to have clean water.
Why does it have to be switched on then? Why couldn't they fix it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
It would just seem like a completely pointless conflict.
Yeah, it was
that was the thing.
It was very arbitrary. I don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm getting angry.
Yeah, I think we're done on the Fallout. At least for this episode, anyway.
Getting angry.
I still like both games, but it's just they both have their own.
I mean to go back and play. You know, maybe play not the plot, but just play and. You know, because there was a lot that I didn't get to, not as much exploration as I wanted to do, and you know, I still find some of the things in there interesting. But yeah, I won't be playing the plot. Dad, I'm never going to see you again, dog. Sorry.
See, that would have been interesting if they'd made the ending or like even different parts of the game depending on which followers you had with you, or if you didn't have one with you. So maybe like if you had dog meat at the end of the game, he would burst through the glass and drag you out or something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And then, but then he dies, but you're okay.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
You know what I mean? But that doesn't seem to occur to them. Like, you have the followers, and they're just puppets. They don't actually...
Well, I think they wanted to try to have it...
Not really involved.
I think they just want to try to have it in the end of the game, right? Here's the end of the game.
Oh, no, I can understand that. But, like, you know, the followers themselves?
Yeah.
They never... They don't have any agency in the world either.
Yeah, I didn't have any followers. Except for Fock.
Fox.
At the very end when I was just trying to power through. Yeah. It was. Yeah, you're right. The followers didn't make a whole lot of sense. I understand why you have Dogmeat in there, because he's such a kind of seminal
icon.
Yeah, he's iconic of the series, but the rest of them, who care? They were too stupid to be useful. And
they would always aggro as well. You couldn't make them sneak.
Right, exactly. And they'd always end up, you know, dying anyway. So just, I don't need that. I'm better off by myself in that world. Much better.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I actually quite liked having the ghoul with me. I enjoyed coming in. And that was the thing. There wasn't really... You could talk with them, and you could find out a little about the past and stuff if you... But it wasn't interactive the same way as it was in Baldur's Gate 2, or, you know, there's just so many things that could have done a little bit better.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, let's draw a line under that.
Yep. Okay, good.
I'm gonna put my time on again. I'm gonna spend a couple more minutes just talking about the last two games that I've been playing.
Yeah.
Because they're kind of the same thing. Master of Orion 1 and 2.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Two of my favorites.
I think Master of Orion 1 is probably one of the best games of all time.
I'm right there with you.
After having played it. And it's, even though the graphics are aged, the game systems aren't aged at all.
Right.
The interface is a little bit clunky,
yes.
And some of the things that they explain it isn't that great. I mean, it relies on the manual again, as we talked about before that. But the game itself, the way it works really well.
Yes.
It's, you know, so often you get a game these days, all through the past, and the game doesn't work properly, or, you know, it doesn't quite mesh. And okay, fair enough. The Mentors, whatever they're called, Cylons. They're a bit overpowered with their research bonus. But apart from that, the way you design your ships, and you only have six classes available to you, adding a bit of tactics.
Yep.
Or sorry, strategy. Sorry,
yep, not tactics, strategy. Yep.
Strategy in how you're going to evolve your fleet, because you can't make a massive fleet and then have them completely useless and then lose them, basically. Because when you get rid of a ship type, they all disappear.
Right.
So it's kind of like a check and balance system to make it so even though you're powerful, you never really, unless you want to have really, well, the threat of having obsolete ships fighting against enemy ships that are more powerful than you, then, you know, you need to keep a fairly small fleet.
Right.
Even if you can afford a big one.
Well, yeah, and it does give you it gives you a strategic decision to trade off. Do I upgrade,
mm-hmm.
or do I maintain my fleet as it is now? You know, mm-hmm. maybe I just fought a war and I have a bunch of these, you know, large, you know, warships, and all of a sudden, you know, I've gotten the tech to you know, with better weapons and better missiles, it really makes you do I really want to invest in those again, or do I want to just keep building what I have? Is that good enough for what I have? And it makes you really pay attention to the knowledge that you've gained on the other races, because it could be that what you have is good enough, and these races aren't, you know, are par or worse than you. And so yeah. you don't need to tech up. You don't feel like you always have to tech up just because you can, right?
Okay, because I'm not really... I always tech up as much as I can because I haven't really gotten to that side of the game yet. I played through 3 times now.
Yeah.
And I won once by being voted the leader yeah. of the universe.
The diplomacy victory.
And the other two by just winning outright.
Right.
I said, no, the other one by winning outright. The other one, I didn't... I kind of got bogged down in the massive war and then ended up losing, I think.
Right.
Because... They just all kind of caught up with me technologically wise.
Right.
But I hadn't quite. I'd sussed out anti espionage, whatever it's called.
Right.
But I hadn't sussed out. I worked out how to sabotage things, but not how to gain more information from the
right
things.
Well, and the other cool thing about it is this kind of fog of war around intelligence, right? Because you may think. That you know where they are technologically, but that may be wrong. And so you may be basing yeah. your decisions, you know, these big decisions upon false information, which is very interesting, well, right?
Yeah, especially when they have older ships that come to you to fight.
Right.
And you think, you know, you batter them and you think, oh, yeah, I'm doing well.
Yeah.
And they're actually the remnants of a fleet they're about to, disband.
Yeah, they're sending them against you because they want them to be destroyed, right? They're going to weaken you by using them. And the AI in the game is pretty good. I mean, sometimes there's some dumbass stuff, but
it doesn't do that thing where they send one or two ships,
right.
generally, you know what I mean? Right. They will make fleets, and they'll have different tactics as well. I've noticed some races, they have tactic of using many, many small ships rather than big ones. So they're faster to build, but they have like 150 of them.
Right.
And one of those groups firing once destroys even your hugest ships.
Yeah.
Which is a...
Yeah, that's... That, Messer Orion, the first one, is one of my best... Your most favorite games of all time, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and another thing I really love as well is the more realistic research. So in pretty much every single other game I've ever played, whenever you do research, you research one thing at a time, whether that's one area of research or whether it's a tech tree advancement.
Yeah.
In this game, you have a tech budget which you increase or decrease for different areas.
Yes.
And that, to me, it's so logical. Yes. It makes so much sense. It reflects the real world. And it works really well because it means that you're never falling behind in one area unless you want to.
Right. And that was one of the things that, when they went from the first Master Orion to the second one, that they lost, which was very disappointing to me because I really liked the multiple research path. And there's very few games that actually let you do that. There's a series called Space Empires, which is kind of a small independent game that lets you do that, that has multiple research paths. And it's different in the sense that you have so many research choices and you have such a limited research budget that you can't research everything. And so you really have to pick what you want to research at any given time. So it's like, hey... It looks like I'm going to go to war. I really need to research, armor and shields and weapons. And I think there's different weapon types that you can research as well. And so I take off all of my civilization benefiting research, and put everything into that. Or, if you're in a peaceful area, peaceful time, you can take off the weapons. But you always have that trade-off, right? If I don't keep learning, keep upgrading my weapon tech, I have that chance where if I get into a scrape, I'm going to have worse weapon tech. I mean, Space Empires is an interesting game. It has a lot of flaws, which is why it's not better known. But that research model, they took directly out of Mu, is very obvious.
Mm-hmm.
I wish more of these space games or more of the strategy games in general.
Just in general.
Let you research more than one thing at a time because it is ridiculous.
That would really add another layer of strategy to games like even like StarCraft.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So where you've got a tech tree of having to upgrade to a thingamajig bay or whatever, what if you did that spread out over a couple of things, you know, and that could potentially increase the number of viable build orders and stuff like
that. Right, I agree with that. I think, I wish they hadn't lost that. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed Master of Orion because, like I said, that's one of my favorite games.
If anyone's listening and they're worried about it being too old school, because that is one of the things, even with Fallout, there's that level of old design philosophy.
Yeah.
Mu is one of those games that transcends, it's so well designed, it transcends any era it's in.
Yes.
The only difficulty is perhaps learning some of the systems and also getting it to run if you didn't have DOSBox.
Right. Well, if you buy it from our buddies at Good Old Games, man, you don't have to worry about it. It runs right out of the box and runs great. I mean, I had a copy of it on my hard drive that I've been carrying around with me because, you know, since it's an old game, it kind of it doesn't need it can just move around, right? You don't need to reinstall it. And but I went and bought it off of Good Old Games just because I want to make sure I had an installable copy that I could archive off somewhere just in case my current hard drive decides to go away, because it's such a it's such a game that I always want to have available, and I do go back to it quite a bit.
And there aren't many games like that at all. I mean, even games like Command and Conquer, which I think are classics as well, for you know, just for its kind of place in the kind of pantheon of Dune 2 and stuff like that.
Right.
They to me aren't as revisitable as Mu is.
Right. Yeah.
There's, The way they're designed, it's too clunky.
Yeah,
compared to how games are these days.
They rely on the user interface too much, and the user interface has moved on to such a degree that it's hard to go backwards. Whereas this, you know, not many people play these games, so the user interface is so simple that you don't, you know, once you get into it and account for a little bit of the clunkiness, you know, it's still well worth playing.
After
all this time, I think.
And it's interesting as well, because I'm looking at, because I played Galship 2 a lot a couple of years ago, and I really enjoyed that game. That was one of my favorite games of all time until I played Mu, which I think is far superior. That, you know, we talked about the weapons before. One of the things with Masters of, Galactic Civilizations, they focused a lot on rock, paper, scissors. And so you'd end up, even if you did loads of research, you could end up in a situation where you're going to be destroyed just because you didn't have the right weapon technology.
Right, yeah.
Whereas in Masters of Orion, they although they have the different types of technologies, they all work. They're all viable. Even though they may have some resistances or whatever, they're still viable.
Yeah, generally everybody has the same weapons, right? So
yeah.
You're all kind of on an even playing field. There's no differentiated tech trees, which makes it easier for them to balance, right? Because everybody's the same, there's no balance problems. That's one way they kind of got around that. Plus, you know, it's such an old game that I'm sure differentiated tech trees, there's no way they could have done it, but not easily.
Possibly, I don't know. Yeah.
So what about Master... I'm sorry.
I was going to say that kind of made it sad to move on to Master of Orion 2.
Oh, well, now, see... Okay.
I don't think it's as good a game as Mu 1.
I'd agree with you, but I think it's still one of my...
It's still good.
Top 25 games, personally.
Out of that and Galaxy 2, I think I prefer Galaxy 2.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there are some things that are nice in it, like... your fleets automatically upgrade,
right?
When you get new tech,
yep.
Which is, I think, that compensates a little bit for the kind of the research being reduced to one item at a time.
Right.
And it's also nice that you can colonize different planets in the sector,
yep.
And you can keep them alive because there aren't very many habitable planets,
right,
in the universe,
yeah.
And most of them are. You know, they're resource rich, but they're lacking in the ability to keep the population alive.
Right.
And it's good you can have trade ships to go and, you know, to balance out the kind of surplus in one place with the surplus in another.
Right.
And you know, the deficit in the other. And that's quite an interesting mechanic. But the game itself, it for me, I don't know whether I'm playing it wrong or something, but it goes too fast. Like, you're always in a rush. You never feel like it. I never felt like I was ever in control when I was playing it. I played it through two times.
Mm-hmm.
I got beat really badly both times. I think the first time because I'd been researching planetary improvements, but not so much on the military side.
Right.
And they came through with a couple of ships, and even though I had like I think destroyers and cruisers or whatever, they just got battered.
Right.
And there wasn't any way to recover because they just came straight through my thing. I didn't expand fast enough.
Right.
Which is also one of the problems I had.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit more aggressive. I think the other thing is that the race differentiation is a lot more pronounced. And the AI is a lot better at taking advantage of the differentiation in races. So, for instance, if you're playing, I don't know, the Silicoids, right? If I remember right, the Silicoids, they can live anywhere. You know, they're slower to grow, but they can live on pretty much any planet. They eat rocks, so they need food.
Terraforming things.
Yeah. So they're much better at going after richer, you know, the rich planets because they don't have these, you know, environmental characteristics that they have to take into account. So they don't have to research whole portions of the tech tree. So they can concentrate more on, you know, taking up the military, and production. And I think the AI is much better at taking advantage of that than obviously in regular Mu.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
The other thing about Mu 2 that kind of is a game breaker, but, if you want to get into it is go make a custom race.
All right.
When you design a custom race, you basically gives you all these different attributes and you get like 10 points and each attribute costs a certain amount of points and you can have negative attributes that give you points back. And the first thing you should do is get creative, right? The creative attribute, what it does is, you know how when you're doing research.
Does it make it randomly get it?
Well, what you do is you, instead of it randomly picking one from the research tree you're choosing, you get all of them.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, that makes the game quite a bit easier because you have all the tech in that one tree, so you don't have to worry about getting whatever the computer decided you should get. And so there's some other things that are good to take, but that's probably the most important one.
Wow.
So try playing another game like that. And then also, yeah, you have to be a little bit aggressive. You have to go and expand quickly.
That was one of the things that I disliked about the game as well. I think I can possibly turn it off. I didn't do it two times I played it. Was that the AI enemies would capitulate too fast. Like, all of a sudden, like a fairly big empire, it'd be in a bit of a battle, and then all of a sudden, they'd just capitulate to the enemy, and then that whole territory would be theirs.
Yeah, well, I think the reason why they did that is so these games suffer from a pretty big flaw in that if you don't have something like some mechanic like that, then the end of the game becomes not fun because it's a foregone it's a foregone conclusion that you're going to win, and if you go in and have to stamp everybody out, not the best of times.
And Galaxy 2 suffers from that as well.
Yeah.
But it just meant that the game was over too fast because no one was fighting. It was ending up being a complete, you know, everyone was laying down on the back and letting themselves get, you know, entered.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, you just, again, you have to be a little bit more, you have to be a bit more aggressive, in going out after stuff. Don't be afraid to be a little bit of a warmonger and try not to get hemmed in. If you start like in a corner of the galaxy, you need to make sure you don't get stuck there because that's a bad place to be. If you don't have any place to expand or easily expand, especially in the earlier techs where you don't have you can't go as far, it'll be a short game and not very much fun.
I don't know. I mean, I didn't win one single battle. I was the first game mostly because I was actually trapped. There was no stars within reach apart from this one, and it had a space amoeba on it or something, and that just killed everyone. Yeah. And I made a massive fleet, and they all got killed.
Yeah, yeah. I think the space monsters are an interesting mechanic in that game. You know, they had the space crystal in the first game. Did you ever run across that?
Yeah.
That's a pain in the ass, but
yeah.
This, they have different ones.
At least you can kill it, though. At least it was doable.
Well, you can kill these guys. But that's kind of a proving point for your fleet. Once you know that you can kill a space amoeba, or I can't remember what the other one is, but then you know that your fleet is really pretty.
It's the Guardian, isn't it?
The Guardian of Orion, he's by far the toughest.
Okay.
But Orion has such good in-game tech that it makes it worth striving for, right? I mean, at some point you want to try to pick that up because it does, you know, first of all, you know, the system has great planets, but also when you defeat the Guardian, you get all of this tech, and that's really, you know, probably overpowered, but I think that's the point is, you know, you fight this tough Guardian off, I mean, you really get some really nice rewards from it. So, I think that again, there's that risk reward thing. I mean, you can go blunt your fleet against it numerous times until you realize just how tough it is. And then, when you finally get it, it's very satisfying in a gameplay perspective. The other thing that's kind of annoying is the Antarans, who will randomly show up and raid your,
You know, they're like a parallel dimension.
Yeah. I always turn them off because they just piss me off. Again, it's another go to try to get you to really focus more on the military and less on just turtling. I mean, the game is really about pushing you into expansion much more so than the first game. And keep you from just, you know, settling your, you know, whatever, you know, however many systems you get, and then just turtling up, and then
because you could, if you started building planetary defenses, you pretty much became invulnerable.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah,
if you had enough of them.
Yes, and it's pretty easy to get enough of them. You just set what I always do is set the slider on 2 or 3 notches on MO1 and lock it, and then I'm always building. You know, at least get one satellite a turn.
It's like ecology or whatever. You keep it on the minimum for clean or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, except for this one, just keep it a couple of notches to the right, and then you just forget about it. And, you know, before you know it, you have formidable defenses that will totally keep all your planets safe. And so, and they don't cost any upkeep that I remember. So you can have as many as you want. Like, I had planets which had 200 defense satellites with, you know, level 15 shield or 20 shield, whatever.
Oh, yeah, you get shield as well, that's the thing.
Yeah, so that game turtling is a much more viable strategy in Mu 1 versus Mu 2, where turtling will eventually get you killed off unless you have, you know, some pretty nice starting circumstances.
Yeah, because your planets, development is much slower, isn't it? I think in Mu 2.
Yes.
It felt like it took a lot more to build a ship.
Yes.
In Mu 2 than it does in Mu 1.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other part they're trying to get away from is the huge fleets of doom. In Mu 1, you know, people were building fleets of 32,000 ships.
Oh, really?
Which is the biggest fleet that you could get because it's a signed integer, it turns out. Signed 16-bit integer. And so, yeah, you could get a fleet of 32,000 ships to just go roll over and kill everybody. So here they're trying to get rid of that. And plus, if you play the real-time battles, which I seldom do because they're boring.
They do.
If you have a large fleet, it takes forever, which is why I turn it off, because it's just so slow. And
is that in Mu 1 or Mu 2?
Mu 2.
Okay, yeah.
Mu 2. Mu 1 is boring. The battles aren't that great either, but...
Yeah, at least you can automate them, can't you?
Yeah, they go pretty quick.
Is there any way to skip them? Because I've found sometimes you'll get a thing where you're just going on and on and on and on. You don't actually end up winning the engagements, but you're not defeated either.
Yeah, eventually you can just retreat. If you're good at, you know, or...
Oh, no, but I want it, like, I'm trying to whittle down planet defense.
Oh, I don't know. I don't recall any way to automate it, but there may be. so maybe.
Okay. Sometimes you just want to resolve it and get out and go to the next.
Yeah, no, Blue One, you're gonna watch that screen. You're gonna watch that screen. They want you to watch that screen, and you're gonna watch a lot.
It's the only downside I'm pretty much aware of.
Yeah.
So far.
But Mutu is don't try to play it like Mu One. It's its own game. It takes different strategies to be successful, and you know, because it's not so much a sequel as it is kind of a reimagining of the universe. I mean, it really was a sequel, but it really is a reimagining of the Mutu mechanics.
And yeah, because you do still have all Orion and stuff like that, don't you?
Right. Yes, but you're not. But again, it's not. You can't treat it as a in the same way that none of the. You know, that's one of the big bitches about the game when it first came out was people were whining because all of their beloved strategies in the first game were useless in the second game, and it took a bit of time for people to understand and get up to speed on it. It's a deeper game, I think. So you're not going to be able to just pick it up and play a couple games and feel like you've mastered it. I mean, it really does. Well, yeah, but
I was just going to say, I don't feel like, don't get me wrong, I don't feel like I've mastered. I'm still playing on easy on Move 1.
Well, what I'm saying, I wasn't picking it up, I was just throwing out a general term, but that happened to hit. But you know, it is a much deeper game, and you really kind of have to understand a lot more what races you're playing against.
Okay.
Because the AI takes much better advantage of those specific racial talents, and so you have to pay attention a lot more, I guess, is the point. Whereas in Mu 1, yeah, I mean, you're playing against the Bulrothi, you know, okay, but you don't really see the differences as much.
No, yeah, it depends on how big the planet, how many planets we've got, really, I think.
Right, right.
More than the individual differences.
Right. And so I give it a shot, give it a couple more times. Maybe read the manual. I would suggest downloading and reading the manual because it does do, if I remember correctly, it does do a pretty good job of explaining the differences in the games and then also, you know, what to look for and what a lot of the stuff really means.
Okay. Yeah,
and then also do a create your own race thing because I think that might be
the way to go.
That may be a little bit cheesy, but also it's kind of fun to have your own race. And
yeah, well, I always did in Galcio. I always made my own race.
Right, a similar sort of thing. I mean, Galcio is very much even though it's kind of a remake of the original OS2 game. I mean, these games have a lot of similarities. I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, well, they're both turn-based, but I always found Galcio to be a little soulless for me. Soulless. I don't know why. I don't know why that is. I just never really felt like it. I never really gave a crap about my race. I never really. I was just kind of playing a game. I don't know why that is, but I can't really put my finger on it. I actually thought about it a bit, which is kind of sad. But
I think Galcio. It's possibly a bit more of an ambitious game than Mu 2 and Mu 1. Like, they try, because they've got the whole design your own ship thing, and
right.
keep, you know, which actually takes a long time if you do it properly.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And I tend to just kind of do my own thing, and like very, very quickly, so it's not like I'm not really bothered about kind of thing. Like, make them look passable, but not, I don't spend tons of time on it. But I think. One of the problems is to have a good game, in my opinion, of Galcio 2, you need to have a big universe. What that also means is you spend a lot of time doing nothing and interacting with nothing. And then at the end of the game, you spend a lot of time mopping up if you have, like, you know, capitulate turned off, which I always do, because the AI capitulates under the stupidest circumstances.
Yeah.
I wish, like, if they made it so that it was a bit more logical than when it surrendered, then I'd probably turn it on. But it still wasn't fixed as of the last mini expansion.
Right.
In Galcio 2. But I mean, there's still, I think, to be fair, I think they're all good games. I think of my particular playstyle, because I must admit, I'm not actually very good at the strategy games. So Mu 1 for me is the most user friendly, most noob friendly.
I can see that. I mean, it's an easy game. The concepts are pretty easy. It's not too. I mean, you feel like you're doing great things, right? You're enacting a strategy, but the mechanics are not very complicated.
Yeah.
Right. Versus,
and you do feel like you have an impact.
Right. You know, whereas Mu 2 is a little bit more of a quite a bit more strategy and a little bit more fiddly bits, if you will, that you have to kind of concern yourself with. So yeah. I mean, it's a deeper strategy game, but I don't know. Like I said, it's a quite different game from the first game. Quite different.
I think that's very brave, actually, to do that. It's such a well loved game as well.
Yes.
I mean, you can't imagine Activision or Bethesda or even BioWare doing that, can you?
Not these days. I mean, their capacity to take risk is much diminished, right? I mean,
cost of games.
Yeah, these games were not, they weren't cheap to make, I don't think, but they weren't, $20 million. I don't think anybody spent a million. No. I would be surprised if they spent $1 million making both of these games, right?
Even Gal Civ wasn't that expensive.
Right.
Relatively.
Right. And then just one other thing I want to point out. If you go to Google Games and you're looking at Master of Orion series, there's this thing called Master of Orion 3. Do not buy it. Don't buy it.
So you're saying we should pirate it instead? I'm not sure I can condone that message.
Don't pirate it. Don't touch it. If you click on the link on God, wash your hands afterwards. It's a horrible, horrible, horrible game.
Was it the same studio that made it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No.
Is it one of these soulless cash-ins like, what's it called? It's going to be?
No, it's very ambitious reimagining of Master of Orion, right? Which has already been reimagined in Master of Orion 2. But they wanted to take it to the nth degree.
Wow.
And they had.
Was it in neon colors?
No, it's.
And I think it was like radical. It was like radical, man. Radical lasers.
It's. The problem with the game is it's so ambitious that it's. Fails spectacular. Well, not spectacular, because there's nothing spectacular about the game. It fails abysmally. It's just a horrid, horrid mess.
It almost sounds worth to buy it just to see it, because it's so rare that a game does that. You know what I mean? Usually a game will be bad or average, but it's very rare that a game's excellent or so abysmally poor that everyone hates it.
Everyone hates this game. Everyone hates this game. You should hate it just because it exists.
Okay.
And you exist at the same space-time continuum. It's horrid. Yeah. So just a friendly public service announcement. Don't even bother clicking on it. It is a terrible, terrible game. It's just so broken. Nothing works. It's just a... And I was so disappointed when I got it. This is one of those games... I don't usually do this, but this is one of those games that... It was announced. I was so psyched because you can't have enough Mu in the world.
Did it ruin your naivete? Is what it says.
It really kind of did in a lot of ways. This was probably the last game that I got super hyped about. And
is this why you're so jaded now?
This is one of the reasons. Yes, absolutely one of the reasons. No doubt about it. Just don't.
I think we're going to end the podcast in a few minutes. I think as a project for next episode, have our top 10 games and top worst games, 10 top games and 10 top worst.
Ooh, I don't know if I can do a 10 bottom worst. I'll try.
Okay, we could do 5 then. Say 5 bottom games.
I'll do as many as I can think of. How about that?
Okay, well, there's more than 10 for the other ones, right?
We'll limit it at 10, but I'll do as many up to 10 as I can.
Okay.
But you know my number one already. This is kind of a spoiler.
Oh, go on. Is this kind of to entice people to come back and listen to the next episode?
Well, my number one, we just talked about it.
Only two?
Three.
Oh, sorry. Worst. I was thinking about you. Your worst, okay. I was like, what?
top worst. Bottom worst.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I could have predicted that. I would have quite clocked what you were talking about.
So now we know. So now you guys, but we want to hear Jim's worst, top, bottom worst, and top 10, and my top 10. That'll be awesome.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to have to think about that. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Actually, we have to think about the podcast.
Ugh. Yeah, because I mean, I've started my job on Monday, so I'm not going to have much time to replay games.
Oh, but you're going to have a job, so you have plenty of time to think about it.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, man.
Okay, so hopefully everyone enjoyed the podcast today. A little bit shorter than usual. Hopefully a little bit more focused. Well, yeah, hope you enjoyed the show.
Not everybody.
Yeah. Actually, before we go, premature. I should say, if you do want to email us any thoughts on the games we've been talking about, or about games you want us to talk about, especially old games, you know, and that we probably have played, or you know, are able to play, you know, a few good old games as well, and just drop us a line at, I think it's theeasiest.button@gmail.com.
Hey, maybe our listeners could email in their top 10 and bottom 10.
Yeah, we could do it.
Games of all time.
Because what I could do then, I could actually put that on the website.
Right.
We could make like a meta list.
Yeah.
And do like a kind of a point system. And then I think that'd be quite good.
So send us in your top games of all time and your bottom, your worst games of all time. That would be interesting to see what everybody thinks.
Definitely, yeah. Just make sure. Yeah, so it's the.easiestbutton@gmail.com. Not the other way around. I always get that wrong. Or you can leave it in the comments on this podcast post as well. That's that hole in my head at blogspot.com. Okay. So, thanks for listening, guys. And we'll see you again next time. See ya.
Have a good week. Bye, everybody.